Welcome to Season 3, Episode 7 of the Filmmaker Film Watcher podcast. I'm filmmaker Richard DiGroio.
And I'm film watcher Greg Ralph.
So this episode, we are going to look at some breakout performances.
So this is Teenage Acme?
No, not John Hughes, Greg. This is three breakout performances which have pretty much defined the careers of these actors.
Well, I might have watched the wrong films. Let's see how we go.
So we've got Cate Blanchett in the 1998 film Elizabeth.
And we have Dustin Hoffman in the 1967 film The Graduate.
And then finally, we have Kate Winslet in the 1994 film Heavenly Creatures. So, Greg, why don't you kick off proceedings and tell us about Elizabeth?
Elizabeth I is played by a young Cate Blanchett in her third feature film after Thank God He Met Lizzie and Oscar and Lucinda. She's the third child of Henry VIII to rule England, inheriting a kingdom at the age of 25 that is riven by sectarian division. This schism is fuelled, if you'll pardon the pun, by burnings and other torture commanded by her deeply Catholic older sister, Queen Mary, Kathy Burke, to remove the stain of Protestantism from England. This 1998 film shows Elizabeth as an innocent who must quickly step up into leadership to save her throne and her nation. While in love with the worldlier Robert Dudley, Joseph Fiennes, and under the guidance of Sir William Cecil, Sir Richard Attenborough, and Sir Francis Walsingham, Geoffrey Rush. This visually sumptuous production is packed with a who's who of modern British actors, including Christopher Eccleston and Angus Dayton as courtiers, Emily Mortimer and Kelly MacDonald as ladies-in-waiting, an unrecognisable James Frayne as the Spanish ambassador, Sir John Gielgud as the Pope, and even Daniel Craig, also known as James Bond, as a priestly assassin on a mission from God. And we have French actors too, Fanny Ardant as a rival queen, and Vincent Cassel in a delightful turn as a not terribly inspired suitor of Elizabeth. Blanchett leads this dazzling cast with confidence and poise. It's a remarkable feat. Director Shekhar Kapoor has an artist's eye for dazzling costumes, often showing Elizabeth in one bold colour against monochromes, emphasising her status as an outsider. He's also alive to the choreography of political intrigue, whether on the dance floor or boating on the river. You have to accept that screenwriter Michael Hirst doesn't let historical truth get in the way of a good story, most obviously with the portrayal of Walsingham as gay and an episode involving a poisoned dress lifted straight out of Greek mythology. Geoffrey Rush and Joseph Fiennes came to this film fresh from the Elizabethan comedy Shakespeare in Love, for which Gwyneth Paltrow beat Blanchett to the Best Actress Oscar. And that win is seen now as the beginning of producer Harvey Weinstein's Oscar campaign machinations. While I enjoy Shakespeare in Love, I think that Blanchett's performance will be the more celebrated in future years. Certainly I remember the local excitement of Australians Kate and Geoffrey leading such a big UK production at the turn of the century and then both being Oscar nominated. Ricardo, what did you think of our Kate?
She really is wonderful in this film. You can really tell from the first time you see her as Elizabeth, young, fresh, innocent,
yep,
to the final frame where she is the Virgin Queen.
Well, she's a statue or a work of art.
That's right. Mm. It's an astounding performance. And look, I agree. I quite liked Shakespeare in Love as well. And look, everybody talked about Gwyneth winning that Oscar over Cate Blanchett because she really was the standout that year.
Mm.
Everybody talked about that performance. So it was quite surprising that Gwyneth did win it. I thought Gwyneth was okay in Shakespeare
But don't
in
forget,
Love.
This is the year too that Judi Dench won for a few minutes on screen as
I know.
Also Elizabeth I.
Elizabeth I.
It was a very
right.
strange set of choices.
That's right. And it was the Oscars, really, where Whoopi Goldberg came out dressed as Elizabeth.
Oh, that's right.
Well.
I've forgotten.
Yeah. But no, she's stunning. She really is. But the film itself, I love this film. I think it's very, very good. I think you're right. There's so much going on here. You know what it reminded me of as I was watching it again?
Let me guess. Game of Thrones?
No.
Oh.
No, not at all. Actually, The Godfather, because it follows a really similar kind of structure from beginning to end. Because mm-hmm. in The Godfather, you have Al Pacino's rise to become the head of the mafia and the similar things happen. I'm not going to give too much away about what happens in The Godfather. But
well, just as well, because confession time, I haven't seen it.
Okay, there we go. But it's a large film.
It is. Yes.
And it is sumptuous. It's got these large echoing halls which it's shot in all the way through. And she's the outsider in this large world. And so that, I think you're right there.
Well, you know what else this film has in common with The Godfather? It's also originally planned as a trilogy.
It was.
Yeah,
yes.
So we've had the first two. Yes. There's no movement that I'm aware of that number three is even in the works. But I could see that the third film would be about the end of her reign.
That's right.
You know, who is going to succeed her?
Let's not get into the golden age. I mean, I was not a fan of that one.
Weren't
there,
you?
The second one. I thought it just fell apart and I was quite bored and I was quite upset by the end of it because I thought it just ruined the first film.
Oh, okay. So I watched that second one in the last half week or so just to prep for this.
Yes.
I didn't mind it.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't like it at all. I thought it started okay, and I think Kate is wonderful in it, and Geoffrey Rush is wonderful in it.
And Clive Owen makes a great dashing
Awful. He's awful. Oh. No. Oh. It turns into Pirates of the Caribbean. It's ridiculous.
Well, at least you didn't say Pirates of Penzance.
Oh, no. It really
I am
is.
The very model of a modern monarch, something or other.
Oh, and then she's on a horse. Oh, come on. No, come on. No, jeepers. This film, though, is amazingly put together and directed. Shekhar Kapoor did such an amazing job in directing this. And you're right, it is sumptuous. The colours are amazing in it. The cinematography is gorgeous as well. And Daniel Craig was bloody frightening as that guy. I remember when I first saw, I hadn't seen Daniel Craig much, but he was frightening when she's looking at this guy coming towards her. And you
and
know that
she's alone
assassin.
In the palace or the abbey wherever
yeah.
she is.
He was frightening. But you know who was great to see back on screen again? John Gielgud. Sir John Gielgud.
Oh, he was barely there.
I know, but
not,
I love seeing
it's not
him
the first
on the screen.
Time, it's not the first time he's played a Pope either.
I know, but still, to see, I forgot he was in it. So it suddenly I went, oh, Sir John. Love seeing him.
He speaks very fondly of you too. You know, speaking of Daniel Craig's character, when he is finally caught... Mm. And is being tortured by Geoffrey Rush's character, Walsingham.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
And when you first see him, he's filmed upside down. And you don't realise until Rush walks into frame.
Yes.
And I went back and watched that a couple of times thinking, why would you do that? And I think, actually, because he's actually arched.
Yes.
But now upside down.
Yeah.
And his arms are extended by ropes, I think. He actually looks like a bloodied angel. In flight.
Yeah, right.
With his hair standing on end because, again, he's upside down.
He's upside down.
And then you see Rush and it inverts and you see he's actually being tortured.
Well,
but
the camera tilts around, then you get Geoffrey Rush's perspective of that.
And again, it's one little instance of just, you know, the eye that's being applied throughout this film.
Mm-hmm.
There's that scene where...
Well, it is very much because the eyes are watching her. So what is it?
Okay.
Her sheets... I mean, her linen has the eye of it.
I noticed
watching.
That, yeah.
So it's filmed as though everybody's watching her, and it is, because she's amongst the wolves. I think it's beautifully done.
And do you remember that scene at the battle against Mary of Guise, the French queen contender?
Yes,
where you see the water running, and then it runs blood red as the camera moves to the left, and then you see the battle scene?
Yes.
You know, that little kind of microcosm of the pollution caused by all these deaths and then moving across into the open expanse again is very beautifully done.
It is, and the screenplay moves so well and tells this story seamlessly. This is where Kate's performance, because films are shot out of sequence.
Mm.
Okay, so your character as an actor, you've got to know where your character is at every specific point of which scene. And she weaves it so perfectly. And but also I want to say the editing of this as well by Jill Bilcock was beautiful as well.
I have to say there are times I found the film heavy-handed. And those times were the heavy choral music at key moments like the conspirators. I just found that a bit too full on.
Oh, I think it was, but I love that full on. At the very beginning when you're I love that.
But you can do that to me. You can do it too many times.
Yeah.
In the same way, he used a shot at least twice in this film, and I saw it again in the second film, where there's the really kind of bright light that washes out the camera. So in the first film...
Well, it's just the white...
Well, in the first film it made sense because there were key moments of transition.
Yes, that's right.
It was when she was, I think, moving from being non-queen to queen.
That's right.
To when she adopted the persona with the white mask. Mm-hmm. But they did again in the second film, and I just... think he's kind of repeating his tricks.
Oh, right. I forgot they repeated it in that film. Believe me, it was very forgettable.
But there are details that I picked up the second time around, or in the third time when I went back and watched some parts. So when the conspirators at the end are arrested, the ones who are going to get it, basically, the Spanish ambassador is killed in a dark corner sitting on his chair as the conspirator in the shadows.
That's right.
And the other three are all arrested during bodily acts. Mm. So one's on the toilet, one's making love to his partner, and one is self-mortifying with a whip. So they were all men, you know, human men, rather now the great lords.
Mm.
And in fact, Wolsey makes that comment, you were Norfolk, dead men have no titles.
That is a great line.
Yes.
And Geoffrey Rush plays this role beautifully.
He does.
He really does.
Yes.
Did he get nominated for an Academy Award for that role?
He did. Did you like Vincent Cassel as the Duc d'Anjou?
Oh, he was fun.
The other thing about this film, and I won't call it a problem, because it is a good film, but they do change history a lot in this film. So I mentioned a couple of examples.
Oh, but there's also Richard Attenborough's character was apparently very young and not old.
Oh, was he?
Yeah.
Mary of Guise was not murdered. You know, it's alleged that Walsingham had sex with her and then kills her in the bed.
Right.
But she died of disease, and from what I've read, at that time where everyone was very suspicious of intrigue and assassination, and watching this film, you can kind of see why.
Yeah, absolutely.
But that, you know, there was no suspicion that she'd be murdered.
They get that so well, and they play that intrigue very well.
Yes, but I thought the poison dress was over the top.
Yeah.
You know, it's the one thing that stands out as, even if you don't know much of the history, and you know, the bits that I've been reading about and so on, but even if you don't know the history, the dressing is just incredible. Yeah, and I sat there watching thinking, I'm sure I'd remember that from history classes or something, if that were true.
Yeah.
And I know that's the story of, I think it's Hercules.
Right.
Someone tried to do that to him. So that kind of playing hard and fast with the truth serves the story, but in the end it is an historical story, and there's a lot of playing of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, there is.
But what did you think overall?
I'm going to give this an 8 out of 10. You know, it's rewatchable for me. I can watch this quite a few times. Its costumes are phenomenal.
It won
best makeup.
Yeah.
I think it did. And best costume, I'm pretty sure it did as well.
Wouldn't surprise me, because the costumes are a standout.
Yeah, they are. They are a standout.
I mean, often you see historical dramas, and they're nominated for Oscars, and they might win. But I think, but that's, what the film's about. In this one, the costumes really serve the characters.
They do. And I think every department excels. So I think as a film as a whole, from screenplay from score to art direction to cinematography to direction to performances, it works.
And I give it the same mark, actually, 8 out of 10.
Mm.
Blanchett is phenomenal in the part, the way she develops the character.
And, you know, it's interesting because there's a film out at the moment called Mary Queen of Scots with Margot Robbie playing Elizabeth the First.
Yep.
And I haven't seen it yet, so I'm interested in seeing it. But I really, it's big shoes to fill.
Yes. The other thing, of course, as you say in this, is Geoffrey Rush's Walsingham. So this can't have been that long after Shine.
Mm.
And yet you couldn't have two such polar opposite characters. A very everything's out there kind of character in Shine to a very contained conspiratorial man in this film.
Oh, and then you look at his...
And yes, and both marvellously.
And then he got an Oscar nomination for, I think it was Shakespeare in Love as well.
Yes, he did for Best Supporting Actor.
I think it's a better film than Shakespeare in Love.
As I said, I really enjoyed Shakespeare in Love. It's a great romp.
It's
not a great film.
It's not. It's a good film, but this is a great film. A bit robbed there.
So, Ricardo, why don't we graduate from Elizabeth? And why don't you tell us about The Graduate?
Okay. Even though Mike Nichols directed many great films, such as Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, Closer, Primary Colours, The Birdcage, just to name a few, his 1967 film, The Graduate, stands tallest amongst them all. The film centres around 21-year-old Benjamin Braddock, Dustin Hoffman, who returns to live with his parents after becoming a very successful graduate. His world should be wonderful. However, Ben has no idea what to do with his life, thus is suffering from extreme anxiety. His parents throwing a party with family and friends asking him what his plans are or telling him what to do adds to this confused feeling. Escaping to be alone to wallow in self-pity, he becomes easy prey for the forceful Mrs. Robinson, Anne Bancroft. She's the wife of his father's business partner who he's known all his life. She's able to slowly but surely seduce him into multiple bouts of casual and secretive sex. He enjoys this affair for a little while, before it begins to add to his tension and anxiety when his parents want him to date and potentially marry Mrs. Robinson's daughter, Elaine. Mrs. Robinson doesn't like this one bit. However, Ben organises a date anyway to make his parents happy. And this doesn't go to plan either, because Ben and Elaine actually fall for one another. And when the affair becomes known, it doesn't go down well, particularly with Mr. Robinson. It fractures the relationship between Elaine and Ben, and then he must do all he can to win her back. Now, The Graduate touched a nerve in the late 1960s, a time when parents stood for middle-class values and the kids were rebellious and at the forefront of a sexual and political revolution. Suddenly, they had choices and questioned the path they were all so set to be on. Benjamin Braddock became the clueless hero of The Graduate, who rode in on that wave of feeling. And it's still fantastic. Simon and Garfunkel's soundtrack is just so memorable. One doesn't even have to see The Graduate and you've heard the classic songs from it. And everyone is just wonderful in this. And of course, this made Dustin Hoffman. Anne Bancroft is equally good though. Her famous line, "Would you like me to seduce you? Is that what you're trying to tell me?" is just classic. Look, they are just so readable between the lines, these two actors, and Dustin Hoffman can look stone-faced and you still get a sense of what he's feeling. Look, it's one of those classics which, even if the themes in the film have dated a bit, the story is still very watchable. Greg, what did you think of The Graduate?
It's interesting how you say that he becomes easy prey for Mrs. Robinson, because the copy of the DVD that I watched for this has a picture on the cover of Dustin Hoffman with a drink in his hand sitting next to a leopard.
Oh, and
I was looking at it thinking, okay, where's the leopard? And then I realised when she first seduces him, she's wearing the leopard skin coat.
Mm-hmm.
And I was watching also during the opening titles, you know, costumes by somebody. And
yeah.
Thinking, oh, I wonder what the costumes are like here. And I was very taken with Hoffman's character's mother's very, you know, mod, op art kind of blouses at one stage. But the leopard skin coat is a very artful little clue about what's going on.
What's going on, yeah.
I think this film is very clearly in three acts.
Mm-hmm.
The first act is about him coming home, meeting his parents' friends, and then being seduced by Mrs. Robinson.
That's right.
The second one is about the continuation of their affair.
Yes.
Or development of it.
Mm-hmm.
And the last third is about when he really connects with Elaine, the daughter, Catherine Ross.
And wants her back.
Yes, and what happens. And I have different responses to the different acts.
Mm-hmm.
I found the first act surprisingly funny.
Yeah.
I wasn't ready for that.
Mm.
I've seen little snippets of this film over the years.
Had you not seen it?
No, I hadn't.
I hadn't seen it in full either.
So the seduction scene, that famous shot of him being viewed through the angles of her stocking, and them running away from a church at one point later in the film, I'd seen those little bits. And I wasn't expecting to enjoy it, and I really enjoyed the first third. I thought it was really funny.
Mm.
The second act is almost surrealistic, the way it merges scenes and even actions across it, and I enjoyed that too in a very different way.
Yeah.
I didn't like the third act. I thought that's where the story really fell apart for me. It was too confused. I stopped believing things. I don't think we saw enough to understand why he fell so passionately for Elaine, because it's not like she was making radical... I mean, she was studying, but she wasn't making radical choices. I think they'd been on one date that we'd seen until he becomes besotted. Again, I just didn't believe it. And then when everyone starts to really arc up about the different responses to he and Elaine and then the discovery of the affair with Mrs. Robinson, I didn't believe the father's visit and some of the things he was saying there, Elaine's father.
Oh, really?
No, I didn't. It was a good performance, but I just didn't believe it. I didn't believe,
I believe
him
that.
Running over town and then kidnapping her from the wedding and the fact she went so willingly when I didn't believe their relationship. So for me,
it was
a strong two-thirds and then it really lost me.
I believe their relationship. I didn't have a problem with that at all, really.
Elaine?
No, I didn't.
I believe the Mrs. Robinson relationship more
than that.
Because
I think they did know each other earlier. I don't think this is the first time he's seen Elaine.
Yes, but he wasn't...
I think they were already pretty pre-matched in some ways. I think the parents have always thought that him and Elaine could get together.
But I didn't believe his emotional response to her or even hers to him.
Oh, wow.
Yes, the context around them, the expectations, yeah. I got that. Mm. And the irony is that you know, they're actually fitting in with their parents' expectations when they're supposed to be rebelling, but I just didn't believe it.
It's quite amazing because Dustin Hoffman was 30.
He was six years younger
than Mrs. Robinson.
Than Anne Bancroft. That's amazing.
It is amazing. It just shows how amazing the performances here are because she holds such weight. She's so good in that role. And he, again, shows such great youth too, and being nearly 30.
Well, she Anne Bancroft is 36 when this film comes out, 35, 36. That's so she's not that old. So she's playing older.
Yes.
He's definitely playing younger.
Got younger.
And there were some times when I didn't believe his age because he's meant to be 20, 21.
Yeah.
He's about to turn 21 when the film opens.
I thought he was 21 when he made it. So I didn't know his age.
No,
I only found out that afterwards. I thought, how old was he when he made this? And it was nearly 30. And I just thought, hang on a minute. He was 21.
I believed her as
older.
I didn't believe him as younger. Now, I've read some of the background of this film. When they were looking for an actor to play the part, he was the antithesis of what they were looking for. They were looking for a blonde college graduate who was very waspish.
Yes.
And then they find Dustin Hoffman, who is Jewish, dark, older than the age.
Mm-hmm.
And he got the part, and I can absolutely see why he got the part. I agree with everything you said in your intro about how good he is in the part. And I can be very AC/DC about Dustin Hoffman. I can find his performances very mannered and that I'm watching Dustin Hoffman play a part.
There's such a stillness.
There was a bit of Rain Man in this character, actually, I thought.
Yeah.
A precursor to Rain Man.
I had a thought of that as well because he was just wonderful in Rain Man. But this here, and there's an opening shot one of the shots where he's in the plane and the camera is just on him, okay? And he's just in his own world. You don't know he's on a plane, right? And this is how beautifully directed it is as well.
Start, yeah. Yes.
And he's on the plane. It's just one shot of him, just stony face. He's looking straight forward, but he's readable. His thoughts are so clear. And as a performer, to do that is very tough. He's a very, very good actor, and I can see why this made him a star. Because, and also, I think the timing as well of the film, like I said in the intro, was very important in him becoming that sort of that hero character.
And there's some very interesting camera work here. So we've mentioned the shot you see him between her arched stocking leg.
But there's also some of the pool shots as well. And in the pool, at one point, just uses his point of view in the goggles.
On the goggles, yes.
In the goggles. And so all you're getting is his point of view. And everybody around him is either dark, the sun's all on him, because that's what it's about. It's all about him.
And being hedonistic.
Yeah. Yep. And every time he's looking at his parents above, the sunlight's behind and they're all dark. So he's seeing faceless people. His parents have become faceless. And there was another shot as well, which I noticed, which was, I don't know, if you've seen Jackie Brown?
No.
You haven't seen a Tarantino. At the very beginning of Quentin Tarantino's Jackie Brown, Pam Grier is walking on a flight, like an airport escalator, one of those flat ones.
Oh, the travelator.
And the camera just moves with the actor as the travelator moves. And
actually, I thought that was a striking shot too.
It's a striking shot, but Tarantino completely rips it off The Graduate. It's exactly the same.
Hmm.
I love Tarantino that way though, because he actually can rip off and do it well. You know.
I think you mean pay homage to.
Pay homage, yes.
Well, the other thing about the last third of the film is that his parents pretty much disappear from the story.
They do, yeah.
And so we never see any of their response to the fact that he's been sleeping with one of their friends.
Yeah, that's quite odd to me because they were...
Again, that's where it falls apart for me,
I kind of agree with you there because they're so involved in the opening.
Yes.
They're so involved in the second act in terms of when they want him to date her.
And they're representing where he's come from and his strictures.
And then suddenly they're not there. We don't see what the parent, what the reaction is between the families. Yeah, you're right. I think that's a little issue there.
There was another really striking shot where Mrs. Robinson is kind of backed into the corner of a whitish corridor and you see him close up in profile. I mean, they're just these shots that you've got someone who's really making his second film after Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf in Mike Nichols,
who's phenomenal. Come
out of a lot of theatre work.
Mm-hmm.
And he's really doing things with the camera that he can't do on stage.
That's right.
Those kind of juxtapositions is very skillful.
Mm-hmm.
And I watched one of those little making of featurettes where they were interviewing contemporary modern directors who were talking about how much they value that film, and they can go back again and again and notice these little details. And I can believe that.
Yeah, well, I found it visually quite lovely. It was quite interesting, actually, because I watched last week, I turned on an old Bond, The Living Daylights. It's Timothy Dalton's very first Bond film.
87, I think.
87. Now, I'd watched The Graduate, and then I watched that, and I went, wow. The filmmaking techniques and the filmmaking used in The Graduate and that director was just so far ahead of what they were doing 20 years later in that Bond film, which wasn't amazing. I thought it was pretty tired, bad filmmaking. So you can see Mike Nichols was a very, very good director back then. And I just think for all of his films have been pretty much very great. I mean, I loved Closer. You know, up until his death, he was very, very good.
The other thing I noticed in The Graduate was the use of overlapping sounds. So you hear the sound of a scene overlapping in the prior scene before you get into that next scene. Mm-hmm. Is that something that he innovated, or was that around before?
I'm not entirely sure about that.
Because it was quite striking.
Yeah.
The other thing I like about this film is that there are a couple of just little cameos by actresses I like. Mm. So, and the two I'm thinking of were at the reception where he goes in to get away from the desk clerk, you know, when he's booking the room for his first affair.
Yes.
And you've got Alice Ghostly on the reception line, who we talked about previously in To Kill a Mockingbird.
Okay.
And I've always liked Alice Ghostly. There's something about her I just like. And the other one next to her is the dotty one, played by Marion Lawn, who was the dotty Aunt Clara in the old Bewitched TV series.
Oh, right. And, okay.
And she's obviously a bit typecast.
Yeah.
But there was a great joke where, after having gone to the hotel and repeatedly with Mrs. Robinson under the pseudonym of Mr. Gladstone, and then he ends up getting taken there for drinks by the daughter Elaine on their first date, and he's saying, oh, I've never been here before, and everyone's saying, Mr. Gladstone, Mr. Gladstone, Mr. Gladstone, and then the Aunt Clara character, Marion Lawn, walks past and says, Mr. Braniff! So it's absolutely, it's a great payoff to that confusion.
Oh, that's just, I didn't pick that up. But, the art direction in this film is also very good. From the pool, everything's so well manicured in that life. So everything should be perfect.
Yeah.
But it's not. And also loved, now you didn't like the end of the film, right, at all?
No.
But I actually quite liked the last shot. Okay, because
on the bus?
Yes, because they've gone on the bus. It's been so manic. He's been after her. She's gotten to him. They've both ran out in this chaos of people. They're trying to grab them, and it's chaos. They run on the bus. They sit at the back. They're smiling. He's laughing. They both look at each other, and then they both look forward. And it's like, what do we do now?
Well, I think the bus is a deliberate parody of the Just Married Car as well, because she's in the bridal outfit and he's in scruffy clothes.
It is, but it was that look of he's gotten what he wants, she's gotten with him, but you still can't move past what has happened. So it's an uncertain future for them.
And I don't mind that scene. I think you're right. But for the last third, I'd lost patience with it, so I'd stopped caring.
Mm.
Whereas, I say, I think the first third was very funny.
Yeah.
In unexpected ways, just it was so well played by the two main characters.
It really was
beautifully played, and I liked the second half, but the first third was the strongest bit for me.
When they split, that's when the film falls down. That's what you're saying.
Who and Dustin and Anne?
Yes,
yeah, probably. I just didn't believe the whole Elaine scenario. Mm. I understood why it was there, and I think it could have been quite promising, but it just didn't work for
me. They are amazing together, though, Dustin Hoffman and Anne Bancroft in this.
Oh yes,
that. When they do split, it's really hard for them to pick up from that because Elaine's not strong like Anne Bancroft is. So I think, yeah, you're right. I think the film does sort of go down a notch anyway.
Yeah, the other part we haven't talked about is there's an extraordinary moment, particularly for 1967, during the seduction scene. Mm. So she's cornered him in the bedroom.
Yes.
She's taken off her clothes.
Oh, yes.
And there's suddenly a flashing shot of her naked breasts.
Yes, that's an amazing set. That's fantastic.
And at the risk of sounding like a bit of a pervert, I had to go back and freeze frame it because I wasn't sure I'd seen what I'd seen. It was so quick in that subliminal advertising kind of way.
Oh, I love the way that was directed.
We can do that now, but in 1967 you couldn't have.
Yeah, wow.
Either on home TV or in the movies, you would have seen it and you wouldn't have been quite sure you saw what you saw, and yet you kind of knew you'd seen it.
I just loved
that
the way...
Shock, the shock was really well conveyed.
It was the way he felt and the way Dustin... I just loved the way that was directed because Dustin Hoffman's looking. He doesn't want to look, but he's seeing these things. Jeez, it's well done.
And then didn't his head turn around three times? Like, It was the one yeah, time because that we saw it three times.
Yeah,
that moment was very well handled.
I think this is a I think still now people will watch this and still enjoy it. I think like I said, the themes have dated a bit, but I don't think the film has dated as such.
And I don't think Catherine Ross is the strongest performer as Elaine. We talked about her previously with Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
Yeah.
And some other films she's in. She's lovely. And she's a very pleasant kind of person, but she wasn't strong enough. I think you're right.
Yeah, she's pleasant and she's lovely and she's very pretty.
And she's not really given a lot enough to do either,
I think. That's right. I mean, I think Dustin Hoffman in those scenes where he's taken her to the strippers.
Oh, he takes her, yes. And he's being an absolute...
And he's being a pig, but he's doing all the work in these scenes.
And the woman dancing behind him.
Oh, she did a lot of work as well there. Yeah, that's right. But anyway, what are you going to give this,
Greg? I'm going to give this a 7.
Okay.
So, as I say, it was the first parts that were the strongest for me. And if it had maintained that, that skill and that believability, this would be right up probably towards a 9 for me, but it just didn't carry through. What about you?
You know what? I'm going to go snap with you there. I was going to give it an 8, but after discussing this with you, I kind of agree with the third act on what you're talking about there.
It must be my charisma.
Yeah, I don't know. But so I'm going to go snap on a 7 as well with that one.
Cool.
And on to our third film, which is 1994's Heavenly Creatures with Kate Winslet.
I'm glad you said that because I thought maybe it was our autobiography. but it's not. This 1994 film, Heavenly Creatures, was one of Peter Jackson's early directorial features, which he co-wrote with his wife, Fran Walsh. Walsh had been fascinated since her Wellington childhood with the violent 1954 murder of a Christchurch woman, bludgeoned to death by her daughter and another schoolgirl. Walsh and Jackson used the daughter's diaries to construct a story of developing obsession between the two girls as they move from a shared romantic escapism to hysterical codependence and fantasising. The film begins with a 2-minute contemporary travelogue that paints Christchurch as a happy town of cyclists and sunny gardens, only to merge into the two bloodied and screaming girls running from the murder scene through the New Zealand bush. We then jump back 2 years as British Juliet, Kate Winslet, arrives at her New Zealand school where she's paired with the sullen, scowling Pauline, Melanie Linsky. Although the two girls are from different social circles, they hit it off immediately, bonding over their dislike of authority and the shared experience of being isolated by childhood illness. At first, their parents are encouraging, but gradually become wary of the girls' relationship and its impact on their well-being. As Juliet's parents' marriage breaks down in parallel with the breakdown in the relationship of Pauline and her mother, Honora, Sarah Pierce, the girls' fantasies become more frenzied, sexual and violent. When they realise that Juliet is to be relocated to South Africa due to her parents' divorce, Pauline decides that her mother is the blocker to an escape with Juliet. And the pair decide to take Honora on a fateful walk after stopping for scones and tea. The skill of this film is that we're taken into the fantasied world of Pauline and Juliet and feel sympathy for them, even though we can see how unhealthy their relationship is becoming and feel dread and then horror at their final actions. Many of the film's highlights are the bringing to life of their fantasies with life-sized clay figures and a black-and-white Orson Welles, often with the lush, romantic music of tenor Mario Lanza. But it's in the closing murder sequence where Jackson's mastery is displayed. Moving from Madame Butterfly's lyrical humming chorus with close-ups of hands and carefully treading feet to the unaccompanied guttural sounds of the mother's agonising death. Puccini's calm, wordless song of optimistic waiting just before your universe is devastated is a magnificent and inspired choice, serving to increase our sense of dread as the mother moves towards her violent death in a serene garden setting. We chose this film as the breakout performance of an 18-year-old Kate Winslet, but it's equally the breakout film for Melanie Linsky, Peter Jackson, Fran Walsh, and perhaps even for New Zealand itself within international film. Winslet is very good, if a little old for the part, but to my mind, this is Linsky's film as the dark heart of its story. Ricardo, what did you think?
This is a superb film. I agree with you with the performances here because Kate Winslet became the biggest star here after this film, but Melanie Linsky is phenomenal as well.
And only discovered shortly before the film started getting made.
Yeah, right. Well, cheapest.
Discovered somewhere in New Zealand.
Oh, wow. Well, she's wonderful. And yes. And they both equally share plaudits for this film and the role. I was a Peter Jackson fan before this film, so I really loved his early work. I loved Meet the Feebles. I loved Brain Dead was just fantastic. I mean, they were just schlocky comic horrors.
Which is one of your genres.
Yeah, well, I really loved them. I thought his sense of humour was fantastic. But to come out with this, you know, the dream sequences in this film, they glide seamlessly throughout this movie. You hardly notice that they are there because you're following their journey so much that you are so emotionally invested in their journey that you could completely just go with them. The dream sequences just flow beautifully.
The final time you enter into their fantasy kingdom,
yes,
that revolving shot reminded me very much of Vertigo.
Yeah, right.
And I had to go back and look again because I thought, have they done what Hitchcock did, which is to show the scenery of the real world and then revolve into the other place? Mm. But in fact, I think what happened there was a cut. And in fact, the whole revolving was done in the kingdom set, but it was done so smoothly, I didn't pick it up the first time round.
But I remember when I first saw, like, even one of the shots which Jackson did when they were building the sandcastle, and the camera just goes right through into the sandcastle,
up the staircase,
and everything.
Looks out the windows.
He had such a visual sensibility. He was such a visual director from early on. So I saw that in Braindead. You saw that in his early work, but this here just stamped his name in just. I mean, he really is a wonderful director. But the thing is, I really love this because this effects are subtle.
I'm not his biggest fan. Mm. Lovely Bones. I read the book and loved the book. And I wasn't that taken with the film.
Yeah.
I thought it was a bit pedestrian given how good the book was.
Mm. He was a massive fan of the book. I was really pleased
that someone had filmed it.
Mm. But what did you think of the effects in it, though? Did you think they went too heavy-handed in the effects there?
I honestly can't remember.
Yeah.
Because I was disappointed against the book, basically.
Mm.
I am not a fan of the Lord of the Rings films.
Oh, come on, Greg.
No. I've never read the books. You read the books?
No, I haven't read the books. But I'm not... Listen. I've seen the director's cuts, and I think the director's... Have you seen the director's cuts of the Lord of the Rings trilogy?
I have seen the first two films only.
Oh, come on.
I was bored.
Bored?
I was bored.
How can you be bored?
And I got the giggles during the first film.
Come on.
You know the scene when Sean Bean's character is in the first film?
Yes.
Is racing up the hill and he gets arrowed and falls over and then gets up again?
Oh, come on.
By that stage...
That's a great scene.
By that stage, I was thinking of the Black Knight from Monty Python's Holy Grail.
No,
I was. I'm sorry. There were times when I enjoyed the visual splendour of it, like those two giant statues either side of a river pass.
What?
I'm sorry.
To find Lord of the Rings is a very tough ask, and I think...
It's a great achievement, but I was bored.
Amazon are about to do a full series of the Lord of the Rings.
And I'm very happy for them.
The most expensive series ever made, apparently.
Oh, and the scene where Cate Blanchett is the Queen of the Elves.
She's great.
And she goes into negative imagery
and
says, "Don't tempt me with the ring." I'm sorry. No, I was... No.
Listen.
I know I'm in a minority about this.
You are a minority.
That's okay. And it's interesting. I think you're probably the first person I know who's really liked the films that hadn't read the books.
Yeah.
Because I think I've typically found that people either do or don't like those films, and it has everything to do with how much they like the books. And I suspect he's probably done a great job of translating them, but I'm not interested in the story.
I think the films have been so successful that not everybody has not seen them. Not read the books, you know. So I think they've...
And he's been a bit stuck in Middle Earth, so most of his films I haven't cared to see. And I haven't seen his early three, you know, Meet the Feebles, Brain Dead. And
this is his best.
And the other one?
This is his best.
Bad Taste?
Oh, I've seen Bad Taste, yes.
I haven't seen any of those.
But what
I do love that he made is The Frighteners. Have you seen that?
Oh, I love The Frighteners.
I really
enjoy The Frighteners.
It's a really fun ghost story, light horror film. And it's done beautifully.
Mm.
And that was between Heavenly Creatures and when he descended to Middle Earth.
Mm. But this is the best.
And I use the word descended deliberately. But let's move on from that. And we know this is a true story. Do you know about what happened to the girls in real life?
Apparently, Juliet actually moved back to the UK with her mother.
I think she went between the mother and the father at different times. Right. But in fact, both women, it now turns out, live in Scotland. And this didn't come out until after the film. They don't have anything to do with each other.
Have they died?
No, they're both...
They're both still living.
Well, see, Juliet's actually quite famous for a different reason.
Oh, wow.
Juliet took the surname of... So you remember the lodger, Bill Perry? The mother, after divorce, marries Bill, and after coming out of jail, you know, on bail, Juliet takes his name, Perry. Right. And in fact, she is now a very well-known crime writer, like a whodunit writer called Anne Perry. I've read one of her books that are all set in Victorian England, in London.
Anne Perry is Juliet who killed the mother. And wow.
And she now writes, you know, sort of Agatha Christie, Lord Peter Wimsey-esque kind of stories. I've said I've only read one set in Victorian England. It's really interesting that she's gone into this whole other life. And yet it revolves around murder. And I don't be too glib about it, but it's, I just find that really interesting.
Well, that is pretty good. I mean, what they did was very grim. I mean, I've seen Heavenly Creatures quite a few times because it is just a filmmaking masterclass. It's an astounding piece
of work. The murder sequence, even though I've seen it before, how it's going to end, I found myself with the humming chorus, I was just getting filled with dread.
Yeah, yeah.
And
I was watching that scene, I was just going, because you know what, the mother... She plays the role so well.
She's very good in the part.
And you just feel for her so much knowing what is about to happen. And the way she dies is just so violent and just with a brick in a stocking being, you know, I don't look forward to that scene every time. But then when it's intercut with them, you know, Juliet leaving on a ship, you know, them being
that fantasy torn of being sisters.
Being sisters. Wow.
There's one key difference for me seeing this film now than when I saw it when it first came out is that I'm now a parent. Mm. And even more than that, I'm the parent of teenagers.
Mm.
And I feel so much more for the mother now. It's a hard act to try and work out the line between discipline and wanting the best for your child and seeing things that they can't yet see and wanting to be on their side or understood and loved. It's a really hard thing. And I think the Honora character comes out in this story really, really well. Yeah. The father's a bit of a duffer, frankly.
Yeah,
and he's played for laughs.
That's right. He is.
And that's a fine performance, what that character's meant to be, but there's a lot more depth to the mother.
But what I think Peter Jackson tried to do here is that, you know, he's trying to show and make us understand the closeness of those two girls and how close they actually got. So for when they were going to be separated, so we could have... Even an inkling of understanding as to why, or even an idea of why they would commit such a brutal act.
And I do understand. I remember the intensity of adolescent friendships when you thought someone was really simpatico with you.
Yes.
And I remember on one occasion, someone that I loved as a friend. The whole family's moving overseas, and I was distraught by that. Now, I didn't go around bashing anybody for brick.
There's no excuse for that, but what I'm saying is what he's trying to do is this act happened. In your mind, you're going, how could that happen? How could two teenage girls, and how can someone murder their mother?
It's a really disturbing film, and I have to say I watched this a couple of days ago, and I slept really poorly that night. Now, it's been hot here in Melbourne where we are, and that didn't help, but it really is a disturbing film, and... I can understand why Fran Walsh was obsessed with this case because two girls committing matricide is a really disturbing thing. It can really just turn your world upside down in understanding how it works.
Mm.
In the same way that I was living for a year in London at the time that James Bulger was kidnapped and killed. Right. So there's a two-year-old boy taken by two boys aged about 11 or 12.
That's right. Yeah.
And then being killed and left on train tracks. That was... very upsetting for me, but for the culture there as well. Just something that you just could not believe was actual. How does that happen?
Mm.
How do children kill an infant?
That's right.
That they've never met before. It's not like they're jealous or something. They just, it's this callous thing. It really, it's a disturbing story. And trying to unpack that, as I think Walsh and Jackson do, to unpack it and to take us into the world and help us understand how they got into that space.
That's right.
Is one of the absolute achievements of this film.
Well, it is.
In a very disturbing way.
It's a massive achievement because it's very difficult to do that. I love the plasticine figures in this and the world of, what is it, Borovnia? when I first watched it, I remember thinking, wow, look at the, how did they do this? Because I don't think the computer generation was not good enough at that time
they,
to do that.
They have
that.
One computer generated scene which now has dated when they,
well,
the garden appears.
The garden morphs, yeah. So that has dated a bit. But these were actually, they had 70 latex costumes. And God, how good are those costumes?
Did you see the note in the credits?
No.
Right towards the end of the credits, there's a note saying, special thanks to the brave Borovnian extras.
Well, they look fantastic. You know, they really do. And they could have looked really cheesy.
Did you spot Peter Jackson?
Yes, I did.
Yes, he had his cameo moment.
Yes, he did.
As a drunk.
As a drunk, yeah, that's right. Oh, I love the Peter Jackson moments. They're fantastic.
Did you realise that as much as possible, they filmed in the actual locations?
Oh, really?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
So the tea room scene, took, you know, just before the murder.
It wouldn't surprise me because it's New Zealand and it's, you know, it's in...
No, the tea room was demolished a couple of weeks after they filmed. They just made it.
Oh, wow.
And then they went to film in the actual place where the murder was committed and they just found it too spooky. Peter Jackson said, you know, the birds were silent. It just felt wrong.
Mm.
So they moved a few hundred yards down the path and filmed there. They really were trying to go for that truth.
Yeah.
Of the actual places.
Well, you know, it's another thing, a beautiful thing about the film is the cinematography by Alan Bollinger. You know, at the very beginning, you see that wonderful travel log of Christchurch, you know, wonderful place, Christchurch. Yes. But the cinematography, there was one tight point at it where I had to have a bathroom break and I paused it. And the still frame looked like a 1950s photograph. That was a real travel log, but in terms of the film itself, echoes that travel log beautifully in terms of the costumes, the hair, the colouring of it looked exactly like a 1950s photo.
I don't think we've said yet enough about Melanie Lynskey, aided by an amazing hairstyle, I have to say. Mm. The hairstyle is bad-tempered.
Yeah, yeah.
She does such a great job of being this really sullen character who is a dark kind of character.
There's so much dimension to
her. And then she just blossoms when Juliet brings this romanticism into her life and she finds someone who understands her and takes her places she's never been before.
Well, it is her film.
I think it is.
You know, this is not Winslet's film. This is her film. Winslet supports her in this movie. This is her story. She kills her mother, you know, and yeah. I mean, yes, it is about their friendship, but she is the film.
And there are little touches. So when they go to the beach, they're bathers.
Yes.
So Kate Winslet's in these gorgeous sort of, you know, mid-blue bathers with big reddy pink flowers all over it. And the Pauline character, Melanie Lynskey, is in these bathers that are kind of a weird ochre colour with bedraggled ruffles on
them.
It looks like the thing that your mother chose for you or maybe your grandmother chose for you. And it just emphasises in that scene how they're from very different places.
Yeah.
And yet they're just enjoying each other's company.
Well, they are. But one thing I think about what's great about Winslet's character in this as well, though, is that she's so confident. She exudes this confidence and, you know, making fun of the teacher and, you know. But when, you know, her parents tell her they're moving away for a little while, she loses it and breaks down. It's just, you know, it's that overconfidence, but underneath the such underconfidence.
Yes.
You know, and she plays that so well.
And there's a wonderfully funny line where she bursts in on her mother and the lodger in bed together, and they're quite clearly, you know, in flagrante delicto.
Yeah.
And the mother says, oh, Mr. Perry is ill, and I'm bringing him a cup of tea. Like, it's completely unbelievable from this marriage therapist who doesn't seem to understand anything about relationships, frankly.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's very funny. The other thing I noticed about this film is that the siblings. So Juliet has a brother and Pauline has an older sister, Wendy.
Yes.
You only see her sister at Christmas and the occasional meal.
Mm-hmm.
The brother you see when Pauline first goes to Juliet's home and is engaged in the game, and then he completely disappears in the film. He's at the beach briefly, but it's like he's been excised out of the family history because that's what Pauline wants. She doesn't want the pesky brother. She wants to be the very, very close sister whom the parents absolutely dote over.
Mm. Well, it's interesting, isn't it, as well, with the homophobia of the times.
Yep.
It's in this film as well. They were obviously in love.
Well, historically, it's not at all clear that the two girls had a sexual relationship. They actually asked about that.
Mm.
And one of them, I think Pauline said, well, how could we do that? We don't even have the parts. Well, words that affect. So there was a very strong naivety between them in terms of sexuality.
Yeah, right.
But that's in the history in the film. Yeah. It's very clear their relationship's becoming very sexual.
Yeah.
And that no one can cope because it's, you know, it's not the done thing.
Mm. Well, Greg, I know what I'm going to give this, but what are you going to give this first and foremost?
Well, it's funny that you know what you're going to give it because I know what I'm going to give it as well. Isn't it amazing?
Yeah, it's amazing.
I really teetered on this one between an 8 and a 9, and I'm going to give it a 9.
Yep.
I think it's very well made. There are little things that just irritated me slightly. I do think Kate Winslet is a bit old to be playing this 15-year-old schoolgirl.
I never saw that. I never thought that was a problem.
But I think the filmmaking mastery and I think Melanie Lynskey's performance, and yeah, as you said earlier, there's an injustice here historically because she really should have just shot to stardom in the back of that performance. She's been very slow burn. She's now made her reputation.
Oh, she has. Yeah, yes, absolutely.
But it was a very different trajectory to Kate Winslet. So it's a 9 for me. It's a film that just stays with you.
Mm.
And I think that that murder scene is just something that just, I don't feel fearful. I don't feel fearful. I feel dread.
Yeah, so do
really
I.
Really deep stomach dread.
Well, this is where I'm giving it a 10. I'm giving it, this is a perfect film for me. I think it's so beautifully done and handled in its subject matter. I think it's a really tough subject matter to approach. Yeah. You've got so many things going on there, and it's so tough, but he does it in such a great way. The screenplay is wonderful. The execution of that screenplay is fantastic. The performances are wonderful. I think it's untouchable. It's perfect.
I'm really surprised by that because there were no dwarves, there were no wizards, there were no flaming dragons, and yet it's a 10. Okay,
yeah.
I will take that away and ponder.
So that concludes our Season 3, Episode 7, Breakout Performances episode.
Yeah, I'm just going to have to take those John Hughes films back to the DVD shop now, I think.
So next episode, we are going to be caught up in politics.
We are, and we're going to look at 3 films that are about ordinary people who find themselves in extraordinary circumstances, in situations of revolution or overthrow.
Mm.
So we're going to start that with the 1982 Jack Lemmon, Sissy Spacek film made by Costa Gavras called Missing, about events in Chile.
Yeah. Then we're going to be looking at the film Reds from 1981, which is a Warren Beatty classic. Which is
Russian Revolution.
Russian Revolution. Yeah.
And then we're going to finish with a film that's not made in the 80s, but set in the 80s,
mm-hmm.
called 1987 When the Day Comes, which is a South Korean film that I caught a year ago,
mm-hmm.
which I found a very, very interesting film. And I'm really keen to get Ricardo and yourselves to watch this.
Yeah, I haven't seen either of these movies. So
you haven't seen any of them?
None of them.
Whereas I've seen 2, I haven't seen Reds before.
So thanks for listening. If you love our podcast, please tell your friends. Please write a review for us on iTunes.
Subscribe.
Subscribe. We're now on Spotify.
Instagram.
Instagram now, so please follow us on Instagram as well. It really helps. Happy listening.
See ya.